as a medical doctor and spent the first 10 years working not only in the British Health Service but doing child health in different parts of the world, particularly in the Middle East, in Iraq, and then in Nepal, Bangladesh and India. After that period of learning a lot about what affects children and their health, their growth and their nutrition, I moved on to be working in some academic organizations in Britain, what they're called the Schools of Tropical Medicine, and then eventually found my way into the British government. As I was making that journey, I learnt that sickness in children is hugely influenced by how well they're nourished. And the way in which the thousands of children that I saw were being nourished was super influenced by what happened in their families, and in particular, because I was working in rural areas of Southeast Asia, by the agriculture systems in which they were being brought up. And so by about 1990, having gone into government, I shifted subtly at first, but then quite deliberately, from doing medicine and health into development. And then as I got more and more into development, getting into agriculture and food. And that's really been where I have concentrated, particularly between 1999 and 2017 as somebody working within the United Nations and within other organizations, how to get food and the systems through which food is produced to be contributing to better nutrition and better well-being, mostly of young children, all over the world. And as we have our discussion now, I'd like to tell you some more about that work and ways in which, over the years, we've been able to push nutrition from being a subject that was somewhat neglected to one that I believe is beginning to receive really high-level policy attention around the world.
Good morning. My name is Lawrence Haddad. I started at a different place to David, but we've, I think, both ended up at a very similar place in our pathways. I'm an economist. I started out in development research, very broadly. In the course of my development research, took me as a young man to India and the Philippines, and I was just shocked and outraged by what I saw in terms of kids that were starving, skin and bone, farmers that were committing suicide because their harvests were not coming in, girls that were being denied food that is routinely given to boys, a really shocking state of affairs. This was all happening in areas where there was a lot of food being grown. This was happening in some households that weren't the poorest of the poor. And so from that day on, I decided to use my economics and my research skills to focus on this very key and life-shaping issue of nutrition. David put it well, if kids are malnourished very early on in life, their brains don't develop properly. Their immune systems don't develop properly. That means they can't learn as much in school. That means that when they get to working in the labor force, they don't earn as much money if they can get a job at all. And it also means that very early life disruption means later on in life, they're more likely to get things like diabetes, overweight, and hypertension and cancers. So, and both of us have dedicated our lives to raising the issue of nutrition, not just from being a health issue, not just being a nice outcome of the development process, but being a fundamental driver of that development process.
And as we've worked more recently in the last 10 years, what we've tried to do is to help governments all over the world be comfortable with the idea that investing in the good nutrition of their citizens is one of the most powerful ways to create societies that are intellectually gifted, that are physically strong, and that are also capable of dealing with some of the complexities that we face in today's world. But if the nutrition is inadequate, you're not getting enough, or if the nutrition is excessive, you're getting too much, that's not so good. And that creates a major handicap on people's ability to perform as they should. And unfortunately, if we look at it worldwide, these nutritional challenges are affecting nearly 3 billion people out of the 7 billion people in our world. So our efforts, particularly in my case through something called the Movement to Scale Up Nutrition, which was pulled together by many people, and I was the coordinator, in 2010, our efforts have been designed to help governments, businesses, non-governmental organizations, scientists, youth groups, church groups, every group that's got some interest in the future of humanity, to prioritize nutrition, but the right nutrition. And so we're here in this wonderful, wonderful moment of the World Food Prize, interacting with agricultural technicians and food scientists and leaders on trying to make sure that nutrition has its right place. Thanks for that. We're talking about the nutritional state of a child early in her or his life as being absolutely key for programming that child as she, let's keep that pronoun, goes into adolescence and adulthood. And there are two key nutritional challenges that we see affecting nearly a billion people in our world. One is the acute shortage of food that happens when there's perhaps a combination of poverty and disease in the home and leads to what we sometimes refer to as the very thin or wasted child. You often see them in films of what's happening in war zones and so on. But the second is more insidious. That's the kind of poor nutrition that happens when there's long-term lack of intake that leads to slowed growth. And the word that's used to describe it medically is stunting. What we find is that if there is long-term undernutrition, that a child who is, say, 3, when you look at that child, actually physically is like a child of 2 because she or he has just not grown adequately. So they're not only short in stature, but also their brains and other parts of their bodies do not grow as they should. So the stunted child is the one who worries us perhaps the most, often undetected, and yet with much less physical and mental performance. One last point in the undernutrition part is that we do sometimes see individuals who've got deficiencies of specific nutrients like vitamin A, key for eyesight, iron really required for blood cells, or iodine vital for the development of the thyroid gland. And these micronutrient deficiencies actually affect a surprising number of people. Some estimate nearly as many as 1 billion people. On the other side of the spectrum, we worry about obesity, which is associated with type 2 diabetes, now one of the leading causes of disability and death in today's world. Heart disease, also diet-related, and some cancers.
And maybe I can add to that. I understand that in Des Moines, on Sunday or Monday, you had your first frost of the year. And frost is a really good analogy to what happens. You know, when you get a first frost, and it kind of damages a young sapling. And that's what malnutrition is to young kids. That's what it does. Think about at birth, a typical healthy baby weighs about 6-7 pounds. 1 pound of that birth weight is brain. That's how much a baby's brain weighs at birth. The brain then at the age of one, the brain then weighs 2 pounds. And an adult brain weighs 3 pounds. So you can kind of get the impression of how quickly that brain is growing. And if there's anything that disrupts that in that first 2 years, it has consequences throughout the life cycle. And just to add to David's point about the types of malnutrition, he went through the types brilliantly. It's important to realize that every country on this planet has a malnutrition problem. United States, the country we come from, the United Kingdom, Iowa, as a state, has massive problems. And so it's the malnutrition is something that can actually bring countries together. It's not about we're great over here and they have problems over there. Everyone has problems. Everyone has to come up with the solutions, the upgrades, as you call them. We all have a responsibility to find them and bring them together. And that's really the spirit of these global goals that the United Nations and all countries of the planet have signed up to. They're for all countries to come together to solve and to achieve. Okay, it is really worrying that these numbers are going up. These are the hunger numbers. They were declining from about a billion down to about 800 million, just below 800 million. The last few years, they've been going up. They're now at about 820, right? The drivers, we think, of that upturn are things like conflict, things like climate variability. Pressure on populations about whether food is produced in the right place at the right time for the right people, whether people have access to the services that are so essential for them that conflict inevitably disrupts. Nutrition can play a role. A focus on nutrition can play a big role. It can reduce the price variability that is driven that climate change drives. If we focus more on having a variety of crops in a variety of places, so diversifying our food systems, that's good for farmers, it's good for communities, it's good for the resilience of the food system. And we know that hungry people and malnourished people are people without hope very often, and hope is something that really drives conflict. So we know that nutrition has something to say for every goal in the Sustainable Development Goals, and especially for peace and for climate mitigation and adaptation.
It really saddens me as a medical person to find that during conflict, the risk of children being really badly nourished rockets up. You sometimes see that as many as 15% of young children of age 2 to 5 are suffering from what we call wasting, which is extreme thinness. We know that is damaging the lives of those children forever. We know that these children have nothing to do with the war that's going on. Sometimes they're referred to as the innocent casualties. We also know that it's not just for their lives that the problem is going to be there. Malnutrition in a child then gets converted into disadvantage in adulthood, which can in turn affect the next generation. At the same time, as Lawrence has just said, but I want to emphasize it, we know that well-nourished children develop much more rounded personalities and can be much better able to cope with stresses in their societies and are much less likely to respond to challenge by going to violence. So for us, I want to really stress this, those who are waging war really need to consider the consequences of what they're doing for current and future generations, for the people who have nothing to do with the war. And so we'd like to see nutrition taken very seriously in war and treated as something that should be spared from the violence that is perhaps thought to be necessary by those who are using war to resolve problems.
And David, you've used the expression nutrition as a road to peace.
Yes.
And I think that's a very appropriate one.
I truly see that.
So, I mean, there's so many decisions that are made about which crops to grow, where, and how. The first thing to say is that not enough crops that are rich in micronutrients are being grown in the places that people are micronutrient deficient. And if they are grown there, so why is that? First of all, agricultural research and development systems are not geared to those kinds of crops. And I'm talking about fruits and vegetables and pulses and dairy and eggs, at least in Africa and Asia. They're not geared to that. So that's a real problem, and that results in an unavailability of those foods, which are so important, such important complements to staple crops. And it means the prices of those foods are going up and up and up. And in fact, we look at trends in Ethiopia and other countries in Africa, the prices of these non-staple foods is skyrocketing. People would have to spend about 50% of their income, the estimates are out there, to purchase 5 fruits and vegetables a day. So we're not talking about bringing the price of more nutritious foods down by 10%. We're talking about bringing that price down by tenfold. That's, I think for David and I, that's the moonshot ask. That's the, how can we make affordable, nutritious foods, how can we make nutritious foods more affordable. But there are a whole range of processes and choices beyond the farm gate that are also really important. How do we store and transport foods? 50% of perishable foods are lost in their journey from farm to market. And those foods tend to be the most nutritious foods. They're the freshest foods. So there are lots of low-tech, efficient cold storage solutions out there, but governments need to incentivize businesses to crowd in. That's a fantastic business opportunity to make this whole thing sustainable. Governments need to do a bit more to encourage people to prime the pump to get them in there. There are other things that can be done, and I can go on for a very long time, but those are the two that jump to mind.
And I'll give you two examples. First of all, to quote my colleague Lawrence, It's necessary to shift the meaning of food from seeing it as fuel for the human engine to seeing it as nourishment for human potential. Once we start doing that, then the choices that are made about food reflect its true meaning for humanity. And secondly, I am so pleased to see that in many countries now, governments are starting to understand the value of enabling people to access fresh vegetables. So in India, there's the beginnings of new farmers' markets of the kind that you also see here, but occurring in small towns and cities all over the country, trying to make access to vegetables more easily available and trying at the same time to link the farmers directly to the market so that there's not so much taking out of the value for the farmer by middle people who don't necessarily add to the opportunities that are happening in the food chain. So more relatively short supply routes for enabling people who need to access vegetables at an affordable price, absolutely key.
It sounds like one of the keys you're talking about is really a shift from calories to
nutrients.
Proper nutrients.
Yep.
I guess one other question I have is, you talked about the importance of early childhood. Address that a little bit more. We've always heard the first 2 years is crucial.
Yep.
But I'm guessing it's pretty important all the way through until adulthood.
The really vital time, just picking on Lawrence's point about the way the brain grows, is from the moment of conception through to the second birthday. It's not an easy time, especially if women are very busy in their homes. They've perhaps got three or four small kids. They're also working in the fields. They probably haven't necessarily got plenty of food in their store. So it's a really critical and delicate time. And when babes get ill with diarrhea or other illnesses, you might, I don't know, those of you who've got children might know that it's quite tricky to maintain intake when child's vomiting or appetite's reduced. So supporting women as they feed their children through that delicate, what we call 1,000-day window, is absolutely key. We're very keen on getting breastfeeding made more available. It's the most wonderful food, and women need space to do that. But other times, just very quickly, before pregnancy seems to be important. So the nutrition of girls in adolescence, and then around the time they might conceive. Nutrition during school days is important. If a child is going to school and is only having one meal a day, it's super hard to learn, particularly by the end of the day. And then nutrition in later life. Often old people actually end up being really poorly nourished because they are not easily able to get the food for themselves. They're dependent on others for their feeding. So those are other times in the life cycle.
And just to add very quickly, it's unless you go and see it, you kind of can't understand the monotony of diets for people at any stage in the life cycle in low-income settings. It's usually some kind of cereal, porridge, with some other little piece of something else. And if we can begin to add a little bit of fish, a little bit of animal source protein, a little bit of eggs, it will make a huge difference to move from calories only to calories plus micronutrients plus proteins, a nutritious diet, not just one that fills the belly.
One last question, we'll wrap up after this one. Thanks
so
much.
Real quick, Mike Pearson from Ag News Daily. We've touched very briefly on the second aspect of this, which is distribution. I was wondering if you could go into a little more detail. What has your research shown governments could be doing to encourage more efficient or more widespread distribution of nutritious food?
I'll give you my example quickly. I worked in a town in East Nepal called Dankuta. The only way we could get there at the beginning was on foot. It was a day and a half. When the road was built into that town, suddenly it was possible for horticulture to get going. The villagers could grow tomatoes and could get those tomatoes to market in the town. They would band together to get a truck or trucks to take that food. A few years later, refrigerated transport became available. And so it wasn't just vegetables going that would then perish perhaps and we'd lose them. By having the refrigeration, there was more possibility of moving. And then lastly, they started keeping chickens and were able to get lots of egg produce, and they were able to get eggs in. Result, greater prosperity in the village, quite extraordinary, but at the same time, better availability of the kind of foods that were needed in the local town. Infrastructure matters.
Infrastructure matters, but people who design infrastructure systems don't think about nutrition. And that's the challenge that people like David and I have. How do we get them to think about developing infrastructure for commerce, yes, but also for nutrition?
And remember that most of the people who work in agriculture and actually deliver the stuff are women and not men, and yet the facilities for women who are involved in going to market or going to the field for all sorts of reasons are not satisfactory.
Do we have any final questions? Last chance from anybody?
We're happy to follow up. If you please email, collar us. Yeah. We do like talking.
Well, thank you very much for joining us this morning, and thank you all as well. Thank you.
It's thank wonderful. You. Thank you, gentlemen, and
you
and
are
you
so important.
And lady, thank you.
You are so important. Yeah. Without you, the message doesn't get out.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to go. Thank you. We have to go to this lunch. No. Oh. Good.
Yeah, we can do
that's
some
exciting.
Step aside. Yeah, yeah,
that's
of course.
Exciting.
Yeah.
Hi, Teresa.
Sorry, a lot of items. Great to meet you. Great to meet you. Thanks for attending our.